The woman you're about to meet grew up in a home filled with music. Linda Neal's mother was a singing teacher, and Linda calls herself a minstrel these days. And indeed, she's been a classical musician, played fiddle in rock and roll bands. She's been a busker. But 10 years ago, she turned away from all that and returned to her hometown of Brisbane to care for her mother, whose world was falling apart. Eventually, she was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. Linda's written about the 4 years she spent caring for her mum in her book, Learning How to Breathe. It's a kind of love song to her mother and indeed to all her family. And Linda's with me in the Life Matters studio. Welcome.
Thank you, Richard.
Before she got sick, what was your mum like?
Looking back, she was a very vibrant woman. Just prior to her, when she first started to really notice something was wrong, she'd just been on a long trip to through America and Canada to workshops for choirs, camps for music, things with my elder sister. And she was always interested in teaching. She was had a full-time teaching practice. She was highly functional, very dynamic and engaged woman.
So she was always teaching and singing, I imagine, singing around the house.
Yes. Yes, right. Singing a lot. Singing was a huge part of our upbringing and a huge part of the family dynamic. I think sometimes I look back and think we actually communicated emotions through music and song more than we were able to verbally.
It's much better than shouting, I think.
I think so.
But you rejected, when you were younger, you rejected the music that she loved, didn't you?
I did. I think that was just part of my particular journey in life. I was a person who needed to create my own music. And I was brought up in orchestras and listened to my mum sing musical comedy, and all of our family were involved in some sort of performance. And I just went, I thought, no, I've got to find my own music. I went on the streets and played my music.
Mm-hmm. But it all, I mean, there's a key incident with the Lonely Goat Herd, which anyone who's ever seen Sound of Music will remember.
Well, I write about this in the book in a quite an amusing way to really configure my rebellion against my mother's music and my mother's voice. There was an incident, and my sisters may remember this differently, where Mum was going to do an amateur show night, and they needed three girls to sing in the Lonely Goat Herd from the Sound of Music. Mm. And Mum, of course, volunteered me and my three sisters. I think the gentleman's mother who was running the show made the costume out of old curtains, much like they did in the Sound of Music. And I just was so stubborn, I just said, no, I'm not going to do it. And my sisters went ahead and did it. It was a great performance, but I just look at back and that I was the Lonely Goat Herd at that point, because I was marginalized for refusing to be involved. And I look back, you know, with sadness for my mum that I was so stubborn and rebellious, but we laughed about it later.
Yes. And yet, in the time that you went back to Brisbane to care for your mum, you both came to appreciate each other's music a bit more, didn't you?
We did. And I think it was because I'd gone far away from it. I'd been in bands. I'd played with people like Ed Cooper around the country. I'd worked with the church. I'd started writing my own music. I'd played lots of sort of improvising music, which in a way is a freedom that's right away from what's come before the musical canon, which it's referred to, and the sort of gods of music.
Yeah, yeah.
I went right outside because I thought, oh, well, I'm going to be a goddess of music. But I'm going to do my own thing.
So when you decide to go back and look after your mother, how did you reach that decision? Was it a very sudden thing or...?
Well, I had just finished playing at a global music harmony festival in northern New South Wales, and I just popped up for a visit. I really did not intend to stay, and life's like that sometimes. You don't know what's ahead of you, and all of a sudden I stayed a week, and then Mum was having some problems, had to go into hospital. I stayed a few more weeks, and I just, maybe it was the right time, but I just got involved. And over a period of time I ended up staying and thought, well, I'll see what happens. Mum might need some help, and that's where I was.
Yeah. It took a long time to get a diagnosis, didn't it?
Yes.
Why was that?
Well, at first, Mum's problems seemed to be vague. What happened was she had a frozen shoulder and she started feeling depressed. She went to a GP. They put her immediately on antidepressants. And so the antidepressants, minute you're on medication, everything becomes veiled, I discovered. Everything is masked by the medication you're on. So she went on for over a year and she started falling. She started to feel more vague. And for quite a while, there wasn't a lot of medical intervention. Mum was just on this medication. And she started to disintegrate. She started to fall. She started to get bruised. It was quite a difficult time.
Parkinson's is an odd thing in that there are these sort of classical symptoms that you're supposed to exhibit if you've got it. But it's still something that there isn't a very, what you might call, detailed and nuanced understanding of, even by the scientist, is there?
No, and the doctors are quite willing to admit that it's not an area that they are fully cognizant of. So it's a difficult thing because no one can say exactly you've got this.
Yes.
So it's a lot of fear involved, a lot of anxiety. And I saw it from the other side, being with Mum and seeing her fear and anxiety about, oh, what might happen.
And a lot of frustration and a lot of things going wrong, obviously. Mm-hmm. And in fact, there's one incident where she's given an Alzheimer's medication, which induces a psychotic episode that lasts for a week. How did that kind of manifest?
Well, I remember some friends of Mum had gone to visit her and they rang me up and said, there's something going on with your mum, what's going on? And I hadn't been since the day before. And I arrived in the morning and Mum was in a terrible state of disarray. I recall just seeing this panic on her face. She thought the hospital was a concentration camp and she tried to flee in a laundry truck. It's very hard to describe the feeling of seeing this once totally competent woman in the state of coming in and out of awareness and the terrible fear that she was going through. And it was the drug. It was obviously the drug. And it took almost a week for that remnants of it to leave her system.
And so you'd already had a few battles with the medical system by then. What was your response? Did you want to get her out of there? What did you do?
Well, I often did, but I was also aware. Everyone was quite aware that I came from a more alternative point of view. But I was also aware that this was Mum's body and this was Mum's life and this was the thing she believed in and trusted. So I was in a quite unusual situation where I felt that there needed to be more dialogue and needed to be more negotiation and more constructive communication, whereas Mum was more into the... And like many, many, many other women and men in her from her generation, really trusted the medical system.
Mm. On Life Matters today, my guest is Linda Neal. Linda's a musician, but she's also written about the 4 years she spent caring for her mother. Her mother had Parkinson's disease. The book's called Learning How to Breathe. And Linda's my guest now. Your mother also lost the ability to sing. I imagine that must have been very difficult and confronting for her.
It brought up an incredible amount of grief, Richard. And it was an incremental process. So that was really harrowing. Incrementally to realise the thing that you'd built up and developed as a gift, as a commitment, as a joy.
As an expression of her identity.
As an expression of her being in the world and inside herself, because she was a professional in that area. But also what it brings to you from the inside, what singing does. And so incrementally to see it gradually lose its power and then to disappear, it was a very harrowing and quite cruel process.
Before that happens, there are moments of song in the hospital. There's the Anzac Day concert put on by your mother's students and there's a very touching moment when you sing with your mother outside the lift and some strangers join in.
That was beautiful. It was one Christmas period where Mum was in hospital on one of her many visits in there to reconstruct her medication program. And one of the things we used to do was walk around the corridors and sing together. And one time I was going and we started singing one of the love songs that Mum used to love to sing with my father. And we started singing together and the lift opened and Mum started conducting the lift people in the lift, and miraculously people there knew the song because it was a song standard. And they started singing, and we all started singing together. And I'll never forget Mum bowing and saying, "This is my daughter. We're just singing together." And so these moments are absolutely precious to me now and then, that this was the way that I came to know my mother in a very intimate and quite loving way.
What was the song?
It was actually called Be My Love. Be my love, 'cause no one else can end this yearning. You know this song?
It's ringing a bell.
One of those old classics.
Yeah.
Maria Lanza used to sing it.
Right.
So Mum used to sing it.
I can see why you've hung on to that moment. You talk also about the shame. This is interesting, I think, that both the patient and the carer feels. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's taken me quite a while to really understand and articulate exactly what I do mean. And I think it's the shame of being put outside what one normally expects would be human experience. You're in an incredibly harrowing state over a long period of time.
Mm.
You come to express your anguish quite clearly, and you feel ashamed for that because you are dealing with people who are not in that same state of anguish. They're functional people, they're professional people in the hospitals, doctors with busy lives. And you're sort of in an abject state sometimes, and the patient too. And I've come across this with other people with Parkinson's. It wasn't just unique to us.
It's interesting to me that you say shame, and I think you've hit the nail on the head, because it's easy to imagine being embarrassed, constantly being embarrassed in a way, by feeling frustrated and upset and maligned. But this is beyond that, isn't it? It's another layer.
Well, it's the vulnerability of all the layers of our so-called functional selves being stripped away by extreme loss, quite regular amounts of grief, and also having to work through this in a way that enables you to keep going. It puts you in a very tender position, and you're aware that you're different. You're aware that you're no longer able to just go, "Oh, it'll be fine," because it won't be fine.
Yes. Out of this experience, you've written a number of songs, and you're going to do one for us. And I should just let everybody know that you're not tucking the violin under your chin. You're going to play it like a ukulele.
Well, what happened, Richard, when I went home to stay with Mum, there was that feeling, as you brought up before, that my creative life was over. Because there's this thing, you have to go far away. I'd been out in the streets, I'd been touring, I'd been in rock bands, and I'd really had a very vibrant experience of my own creativity. And I thought that would pretty well finish. But the life force is very strong in all of us. That's one thing I've discovered. So we're sitting in my mum's lounge room. I started to play in a different way, which is more intimate. And I used to play to my mum when she was sick. I used to play her my songs. She'd go, "Oh, a bit more enunciation in that second verse needed. You need some focus exercises there, Linda." So all the things I used to resist from her, I just meekly go, "Okay, it might make them better." So I found my own voice, started to sing and find my voice when I came home too.
Well, just before you do it, we should mention you're actually artist in residence here at Radio National, working with the program Into the Music with these love songs you've written. What are you actually doing?
Well, I'm making two documentaries about the significance of love songs in our lives. And also, it is connected to the story with Mum in some way, in that I'm really investigating, with the help of a professor of music psychology at Macquarie University, just what effect the incremental singing, the effect of singing love songs day after day over a period of a year would have on a person's mental state, physical state, emotional state, and neurological templates. So in a way, it's taking the terrible loss that I witnessed from my mother losing her voice and turning it into something that maybe can explore and illuminate something that could help others in that situation.
All right. Well, I look forward to hearing that a bit later, but tell me now just about the song you're going to sing us.
Well, the Sorry song is connected to the shame, Richard. It was the first song I wrote after the period, after I stopped caring for Mum. I actually got an opportunity to go to another country for a while. And I started strumming the violin like a little ukulele because I didn't have my violin or my guitar with me. And just the shame and embarrassment that I was referring to just prior to this story, I really felt I needed to apologize, which is a funny thing because we'd been through so much, but in the end you feel like you need to apologize to the functional, normal people for having felt so anguished. And you act outside your comfort zone too. You act in ways that looking back you go, oh, I was really out of line there. I got too emotional. I was too angry. But in the context of the situation, it's understandable. But later you feel like you need to make a blanket apology to everyone. So this song is my way of saying sorry to everyone. Everyone that I'd offended and pissed off during that period. And also my whole life. And it's very, very therapeutic to be able to have a song where you can just say sorry. Okay. As we know in this country.
I'll let you do it now. Well, that was amazing, and that's I'm Sorry by Linda Neal. And Linda's a musician, obviously, as we've just had compelling evidence of. She's also the author of Learning How to Breathe, a true story of love, music and family. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Richard.
The book's published by the University of Queensland Press. This is Life Matters with me, Richard Addy. You're on Radio National.